But she had noticed the first things a city child pays attention to. The lush countryside, the flat green meadows, the golden fields, the intoxicating smell of fresh air and summer, the hum of a bumblebee, birds in the sky, fluffy white clouds. After the stink and heat of the past few days, this was glorious, she felt. Maybe it wasn't going to be that bad after all. She followed her parents through barbed wire gates with stern-looking guards on each side holding guns. And then she saw the rows of long, dark barracks, the grimness of the place, and her spirits sank. She cowered against her mother. Policemen started to shout orders. The women and children were told to go to the sheds on the right, the men on the left. Helpless, holding on to her mother, she watched her father be pushed along with a group of men. She felt afraid without him by her side, but there was nothing she could do. The guns terrified her. Her mother did not move. Her eyes were dulled, dead. Her face was white and sickly. The girl took her mother's hand as they were shoved toward the barracks. The inside was bare and grimy. Planks and straw. Stench and dirt. The latrines were outside. Planks of wood astride holes. They were ordered to sit there, in groups, to piss and defecate in view of all, like animals. It revolted her. She felt she could not go. She could not do this. She looked on as her mother straddled one of the holes. She bowed her head in shame. But she finally did what she was told, cringing, hoping no one was looking at her. Just above the barbed wire, the girl could glimpse the village, the black spire of a church, a water tower, roofs and chimneys, trees. Over there, she thought, in those nearby houses, people had beds, sheets, blankets, food, and water. They were clean. They had clean clothes. Nobody screamed at them. Nobody treated them like cattle. And they were just there, just on the other side of the fence, in the clean little village where she could hear the church bell chime. There were children on vacation over there, she thought. Children going on picnics, children playing hide-and-seek. Happy children. Even if there was a war, and less to eat than usual, and maybe their papa had gone away to fight. Happy, loved, cherished children. She couldn't imagine why there was such a difference between those children and her. She couldn't imagine why she and all these people here with her had to be treated this way. Who had decided this, and what for? They were given tepid cabbage soup. It was thin and sandy. Nothing else. Then she watched as rows of women stripped naked and fought to wash their dirty bodies under a trickle of water over rusty iron wash basins. She found them ugly, grotesque. She hated the flabby ones, the skinny ones, the old ones, the young ones. She hated to have to see their nudity. She did not want to look at them. She hated having to see them. She huddled against her mother's warmth and tried not to think of her brother. Her skin felt itchy, her scalp too. She wanted a bath, her bed, her brother, dinner. She wondered if anything could be worse than what had been happening to her over the past few days. She thought of her friends, of the other little girls in her school who also wore stars. Dominique, Sophie, Agnès. What had happened to them? Had some been able to escape? Were some safe hiding somewhere? Was Armelle hiding with her family? Would she ever see her again? See her other friends again? Would she go back to school in September? That night, she couldn't sleep. She needed her father's reassuring touch. Her stomach hurt her. She felt it contract with pain. She knew they were not allowed to leave the barracks during the night. She clenched her teeth, wrapping her arms around her belly, but the pain grew worse. Slowly she got up, tiptoed through the rows of sleeping women and children, to the latrines outside the door. Glaring spotlights swept the camp as she huddled over the planks. The girl peered in and saw thick, pale worms writhing in the dark mass of shit. She was afraid a policeman up there in the watchtowers would see her bottom, and she pulled her skirt down over her loins. She quickly made her way back to the barrack. Inside, the air was stuffy and foul. Some children whimpered in their sleep. She could hear a woman sobbing. She turned to her mother, gazing at the sunken, white face. Gone was the happy, loving woman. Gone was the mother who used to sweep her into her arms and whisper love words, Yiddish nicknames. The woman with the glossy, honey locks and the voluptuous figure. The one all the neighbors, all the shopkeepers, would greet by her first name. The one who smelled a warm, comforting, motherly smell. Delicious cooking, fresh soap, clean linen. The one with the infectious laugh. The one who said that even if there was a war, they'd pull through because they were a strong, good family, a family full of love. That woman had little by little disappeared. She had become gaunt and pale, and she never smiled or laughed. She smelled rank, bitter. Her hair had become brittle and dry, streaked with gray. The girl felt like her mother was already dead. The old woman looked at Bamber and me with rheumy, translucent eyes. She must be getting on toward 100, I thought. Her smile was toothless, like a baby's. Mamay was a teenager compared to her. She lived just above her son's shop, the news dealer on the Rue Nilaton, a pokey apartment cluttered with dusty furniture, moth-eaten rugs, and withered plants. The old lady sat in a sagging armchair by the window. She watched us walk in and introduce ourselves. She seemed pleased to be entertaining impromptu visitors.
"American journalists, so?"
she quavered, appraising us.
"American and British," corrected Bamber.
"Journalists that are interested in the Veldive?"
she asked. I got my pen and pad of paper out and balanced them on my knee. "Do you remember anything about the roundup, madame?" I asked her. "Could you tell us something? Even the smallest detail?" She let out a cackle.
"You think I don't remember, young lady? You think I have forgotten, maybe?"
"Well," I said, "it was a while ago, after all."
"How old are you?"
she asked bluntly. I felt my face redden. Bamber hid a smile behind his camera. 45, I said.
"I am going to be 95 years old," she said, flaunting decayed gums. "On July 16th, 1942, I was 35, 10 years younger than you are now. And I remember everything."
She paused. Her dimmed eyes looked outside onto the street.
"I remember being woken very early by the rumbling of buses. Buses just outside my window. I looked outside and I saw the buses arrive. More and more buses. Our own city buses, the buses I used every day. Green and white. So many of them. I wondered why on earth they were here. Then I saw the people come out, and all the children. So many children. You see, it's hard to forget the children."
I scribbled away as Bamber slowly clicked his camera.
"After a while I got dressed and went down with my boys, who were small then. We wanted to know what was going on. We were curious. Our neighbors came too, and the concierge. Then we saw the yellow stars, and we understood. The Jews. They were rounding up the Jews."
"Did you have any idea what was going to happen to these people?" I asked. She shrugged her old shoulders.
"No," she said. We had no idea. How could we? It was after the war that we found out. We thought they were being sent to work somewhere. We did not think anything bad was going on. I remember someone said, "It's the French police. No one will harm them." So we did not worry. And the next day, even when this had happened, in the middle of Paris, there was nothing in the papers, nothing on the radio. No one seemed preoccupied, so we weren't either, until I saw the children.
She paused. "The children?" I repeated.
"A few days later, the Jews were taken away again by bus," she continued. "I was standing on the sidewalk, and I saw the families come out of the velodrome. All these dirty, crying children. They looked frightened, filthy. I was appalled. I realized that in the velodrome, they hadn't had much to eat or drink. I felt helpless and angry. I tried to throw them bread and fruit, but the police would not let me."
She paused again. For a long time. She seemed tired all of a sudden, weary. Bamber quietly put his camera away. We waited. We did not move. I wondered if she was going to speak again.
"After all these years,"
she said finally, her voice subdued, almost a whisper.
"After all these years, I still see the children, you know. I see them climbing onto the buses and being driven away. I did not know where they were going, but I had this feeling, this horrible feeling. Most of the people around me were indifferent. They felt like this was normal. It was normal for them that the Jews were being taken away."
"Why do you think they felt that way?" I asked. Another cackle.
"We French had been told for years that Jews were the enemies of our country, that's why. In 41 or 42, there was an exhibit at the Palais Berlitz, if I remember correctly, on the Boulevard des Italiens, called The Jew and France. The Germans made sure it went on for months. A big success with the Parisian population, and what was it? A shocking display of anti-Semitism."
Her gnarled old fingers smoothed out her skirt.
"I remember the policeman, you know. Our own good Parisian policeman, our own good honest gendarme, pushing the children onto the buses. Shouting, using their baton."
She bent her chin to her chest. She mumbled something I did not catch. It sounded like,
"Shame on us all for not having stopped it."
"You didn't know," I said softly, touched by her suddenly watery eyes. "What could you have done?"
"Nobody remembers the Veldiv children, you know. Nobody is interested."
"Maybe this year they will," I said. "Maybe this year it will be different." She pursed her shrunken lips.
"No, you'll see. Nothing has changed. Nobody remembers. Why should they? Those were the darkest days of our country."
She wondered where her father was. Somewhere in the same camp, in one of the sheds, surely, but she only saw him once or twice. She had no notion of the days slipping by. The only thing that haunted her was her brother. She woke at night, trembling, thinking of him in the cupboard. She took out the key and stared at it with pain and horror. Maybe he was dead by now. Maybe he had died of thirst, of hunger. She tried to count the days since that Black Thursday the men had come to get them. A week? 10 days? She didn't know. She felt lost, confused. It had been a whirlwind of terror, starvation, and death. More children had died at the camp. Their little bodies had been taken away amid tears and cries. One morning, she noticed a number of women talking with animation. They looked worried, upset. She asked her mother what was going on, but her mother said she didn't know. Not to be deterred, the girl asked a woman who had a little boy her brother's age and who had slept next to them for the past few days. The woman's face was reddish, as if she had a fever. She said there were rumors going around the camp. The parents were going to be sent east to work. They were to prepare for the arrival of the children who were to come later in a couple of days. The girl listened, shocked. She repeated the conversation to her mother. Her mother's eyes seemed to click open. She shook her head vehemently. She said, "No, that couldn't possibly happen. They couldn't possibly do that. They couldn't separate the children from the parents." In that sheltered, gentle life that seemed far away, the girl would have believed her mother. She used to believe everything her mother said. But in this harsh new world, the girl felt she had grown up. She felt older than her mother. She knew the other women were saying the truth. She knew the rumors were true. She did not know how to explain this to her mother. Her mother had become like a child. When the men came into the barracks, she did not feel afraid. She felt she had been hardened. She felt a thick wall had grown around her. She took her mother's hand and held it tight. She wanted her mother to be brave, to be strong. They were ordered outside. They had to file into another shed by small groups. She waited in line patiently with her mother. She kept looking around her to catch a glimpse of her father. He was nowhere to be seen. When it was their turn to step into the shed, she saw a couple of policemen sitting behind a table. There were two women standing next to the men, wearing ordinary clothes. Women from the village, looking at the lines of people with cold, hard faces. She heard them ordering the old woman in front of her in the line to hand over money and jewelry. She watched the old woman fumble with her wedding ring, her watch. A little girl of 6 or 7 stood next to her, shivering with fear. A policeman pointed to the tiny gold rings the little girl wore in her ears. She was too frightened to take them off herself. The grandmother bent down to unclasp them. The policeman let out a sigh of exasperation. This was going far too slowly. They'd be here all night at this rate. One of the village women went over to the small girl and with a quick gesture yanked the rings through her ears, tearing the tiny lobes. The little girl screamed, her hands creeping to her bloody neck. The old woman screamed too. A policeman hit her in the face. They were pulled outside. A murmur of fear went through the line. The policemen waved their guns. There was silence. The girl and her mother had nothing to hand over, just the mother's wedding band. A florid-faced village woman tore open the mother's dress from collarbone to navel, revealing her pale skin and faded underclothes. Her hands groped through the folds of the dress, to the underclothes, to the openings of the mother's body. The mother flinched, but said nothing. The girl watched, fear rising through her. She hated the way the men eyed her mother's body, hated the way the village woman touched her, handling her like a piece of meat. Were they going to do that to her, too, she wondered? Would they tear her clothes as well? Maybe they would take her key. She clenched it in her pocket with all her might. No, they couldn't take that. She wouldn't let them. She wouldn't let them take the key to the secret cupboard. Never. But the policemen were not interested in what was in her pockets. Before she and her mother stepped aside, she had one last look at the growing piles on the desk. Necklaces, bracelets, brooches, rings, watches, money. What were they going to do with all that? She thought. Sell them? Use them? What did they need these things for? Back outside, they were lined up again. It was a hot and dusty day. The girl was thirsty. Her throat felt prickly and dry. They stood around for a long time under the policeman's silent glare. What was going on? Where was her father? Why were they all standing there? The girl could hear incessant whispers behind her. Nobody knew. Nobody could answer. But she knew. She felt it. And when it happened, she was expecting it. The policemen fell upon them like a swarm of large, dark birds. They dragged the women to one side of the camp, the children to the other. Even the tiniest children were separated from their mothers. The girl watched it all, as if she was in another world. She heard the screams, the yells. She saw the women hurling themselves to the ground, their hands pulling at their children's clothes, their children's hair. She watched the policemen raise their truncheons and bludgeon the women's heads, their faces. She saw a woman collapse, her nose a bloody pulp. Her own mother stood next to her, frozen. She could hear the woman breathing in short, sharp gasps. She held onto her mother's cold hand. She felt the policemen wrench them apart. She heard her mother shriek, and then saw her dive back toward her, her dress gaping open, her hair wild, her mouth contorted, screaming her daughter's name. She tried to grab her mother's hands, but the men shoved her aside, sending her to her knees. Her mother fought like a mad creature, overpowering the policeman for a couple of seconds, and at that precise moment, the girl saw her real mother emerge, the strong, passionate woman she missed and admired. She felt her mother's arms hold her once more, felt the thick, bushy hair caress her face. Suddenly, torrents of cold water blinded her. Spluttering, gasping for breath, she opened her eyes to see the men drag her mother away by the collar of her sopping dress. It seemed to her that it took hours. Tearful, lost children, buckets of water thrown in their faces, struggling, broken women, sharp thuds of the blows, but she knew it had happened very fast. Silence. It was done. At last, the crowd of children stood on one side, the women on the other. Between them, a sturdy row of policemen. The policemen kept repeating that the mothers and the children over 12 were preceding the others, that the younger ones would leave next week to join them. The fathers had already left, they were told. Everybody was to cooperate and obey. She saw her mother stand with the other women. Her mother looked back at her daughter with a tiny, brave smile. She seemed to say, "You see, darling, we'll be all right. The police said so. You'll be coming to join us in a few days. Don't worry, my sweet." The girl looked around her at the crowd of children. So many children. She looked at the toddlers, their faces crumpled with grief and fright. She saw the little girl with the bleeding earlobes, palms outstretched to her mother. What was going to happen to all these children? To her, she thought. Where were their parents being taken? The women were led away, out through the camp gates. She saw her mother head right and walk down the long road that led through the village to the station. Her mother's face turned to her one last time. Then she was gone.
"We're having one of our good days today, Madame Tézac," said Véronique, beaming at me as I walked into the sunny white room. She was part of the staff that looked after Mamet at the clean, cheerful nursing home in the 17th arrondissement, not far from the Parc Monceau.
"Don't call her Madame Tézac," barked Bertrand's grandmother. "She hates it. Call her Miss Germont."
I couldn't help smiling. Véronique seemed crestfallen.
"And anyway, Madame Tézac, that's me,"
said the old lady with a touch of haughtiness and total disdain for the other Madame Tézac, her daughter-in-law Colette, Bertrand's mother. So typical of Mamet, I thought. So feisty, even at her age. Her first name was Marcel. She loathed it. No one ever called her Marcel.
I'm sorry,
said Véronique humbly. I put a hand on her arm. Please, don't worry about it, I said. I don't use my married name.
It's an American thing, said Mamet. Miss Charmant is American. Yes, I had noticed that, said Véronique, in better spirits.
Noticed what? I felt like asking. My accent? My clothes? My shoes?
So you've been having a good day then, Mamet? I sat down next to her and covered her hand with mine. Compared to the old lady on the Rue Nélaton, Mamet looked fresh-faced. Her skin was hardly wrinkled. Her gray eyes were bright. But the old lady of the Rue Nélaton, despite her decrepit appearance, had a clear head. And Mamet, at 85, had Alzheimer's. Some days, she simply could not remember who she was. Bertrand's parents had decided to move her to the nursing home when they realized she was incapable of living alone. She would turn on a gas burner and let it burn all day. She would let her bath run over, or she would regularly lock herself out of the apartment and be found wandering in the Rue de Saint-Ange in her dressing gown. She had put up a fight, of course. She hadn't wanted to come to the nursing home at all. But she had settled in nicely enough, despite occasional outbursts of temper.
I'm having a good day, she grinned as Véronique left us.
Oh, I see, I said. Terrorizing the entire place as usual?
As usual, she said.
Then she turned to me. Her affectionate gray eyes roamed over my face.
Where's that good-for-nothing husband of yours? He never comes, you know. And don't give me any of that he's-too-busy business.
I sighed.
Well, at least you're here, she said gruffly. You look tired. Everything all right?
Fine, I said. I knew I looked tired. There wasn't much I could do about it. Go on vacation, I guess, but that wasn't planned till the summer.
And the apartment?
I had just been to see the work being done before coming to the nursing home. A hive of activity, Bertrand supervising everything with his usual energy, Antoine looking drained. It's going to be wonderful, I said, when it's finished.
I miss it, said Mamet. I miss living there.
I'm sure you do, I said. She shrugged.
You get attached to places, you know, like people, I suppose. I wonder if André ever misses it.
André was her late husband. I had not known him. He had passed away when Bertrand was a teenager. I was used to Mamet's speaking of him in the present tense. I never corrected her, never reminded her that he died years ago of lung cancer. She loved talking about him. When I first met her, long before she started to lose her memory, she would show me her photo albums every time I came to see her at the Rue de Saint-Ange. I felt I knew André Tézac's face by heart. The same gray-blue eyes that Edouard had, a rounder nose, a warmer smile, maybe. Mamet had told me lengthily how they had met, how they had fallen in love, and how everything had become difficult during the war. The Tézac were originally from Burgundy, but when André had inherited a family wine business from his own father, he had not been able to make ends meet. So he had moved to Paris and started a small antique shop on the Rue de Turenne, near the Place des Vosges. It had taken him a while to establish his reputation, for the business to flourish. Edouard had taken over the reins after his father's death and moved the shop to the Rue du Bac in the 7th arrondissement, where the most prestigious antique shops in Paris were found. Cécile, Bertrand's younger sister, was now running the place and doing very well. Mamet's doctor, the mournful but efficient Dr. Roche, once told me it was excellent therapy to ask Mamet about the past. According to him, she probably had a better perception of what went on 30 years ago than that very morning. It was like a little game. During each of my visits, I would ask her questions. I did it naturally, not making a big thing out of it. She knew perfectly well what I was driving at, but pretended to ignore it. It had been amusing finding out about Bertrand as a young boy. Mamet came up with the most interesting tidbits. He had been a gawky adolescent, not the cool dude I had heard of. He was a reluctant scholar, not the brilliant student his parents had raved about. At 14, there had been a memorable fight with his father about the neighbor's daughter, a promiscuous bottle blonde who smoked marijuana. Sometimes, though, it wasn't fun delving into Mamet's faulty memory. Often, there were grim, long blanks. She could not remember anything. On bad days, she shut up like a clam. She would glower at the television and set her mouth so that her chin jutted out. One morning, she couldn't figure out who Zoe was. She kept asking, "Who is this child? What is she doing here?" Zoe, as ever, had been adult about it. But later on that night, I had heard her crying in bed. When I gently asked her what was the matter, she admitted she couldn't bear seeing her great-grandmother growing older. "Mamet," I said, "when did you and André move into the Rue de Saint-Ange apartment?" I expected her to screw up her face, looking like a wise old monkey, and come up with an, "Oh, I can't remember at all." But the answer was like a whiplash. "July, 1942. I sat up straight, staring at her. "July, 1942? I repeated. "That's right," she said. "And how did you find the apartment? There was a war going on. It must have been difficult, surely." "Not at all," she said breezily. "It had been suddenly vacated. We heard about it through the concierge, Madame Aurier, who was friendly with our old concierge. We used to live on the Rue de Turenne, just above André's shop, a cramped, poky little apartment with only one bedroom. So we moved in with Edouard, who was 10 or 12 at the time. We were thrilled to have a bigger place, and it was a cheap rent, I remember. In those days, that quartier was not half as fashionable as it is now." I watched her carefully and cleared my throat. "Mamet, do you remember if this was the beginning of July or the end?" She smiled, pleased to be doing so well. "I remember perfectly. It was the end of July." "And do you remember why the place was vacated so suddenly?" Another beaming smile. "Of course. There had been a big roundup. People were arrested, you know. There were lots of places that were suddenly vacant." I stared at her. Her eyes gazed back at mine. They clouded over when she saw the expression on my face. "But how did it happen? How did you move in?" She fussed with her sleeves, working her mouth.
"Madame Royer told our concierge that an empty three-roomed apartment was free on the Rue de Saint-Ange. That's how it happened, that's all."
Silence. She stopped moving her hands and folded them in her lap.
"But Mamet," I whispered, "didn't you think these people might ever come back?"
Her face had sobered, and there was something tight, painful about her lips.
"We knew nothing," she said finally. "Nothing at all."
And she looked down at her hands and did not speak again. This was the worst night. The worst night ever. For all of the children, and for her, thought the girl. The sheds had been entirely looted. Nothing was left. No clothes, no blankets, nothing. Eiderdowns had been ripped in two, white feathers covering the ground like fake snow. Children crying, children screaming, children hiccuping with terror. The little ones could not understand, kept moaning for their mothers. They wet their clothes, rolled on the ground, shrieked with despair. The older ones, like her, sat on the dirty floor, their heads in their hands. No one looked at them. No one took care of them. They were rarely fed. They were so hungry they nibbled dry grass, bits of straw. No one comforted them. The girl wondered, these policemen, didn't they have families too? Didn't they have children? Children they went home to. How could they treat children this way? Were they told to do so? Or did they act this way naturally? Were they in fact machines, not human beings? She looked closely at them. They seemed of flesh and bone. They were men. She couldn't understand. The next day, the girl noticed a handful of people watching them through the barbed wire. Women with packages of food. They were trying to push the food through the fences, but the policeman ordered them to leave. Nobody came to look at them again. The girl felt like she had become someone else, someone hard and rude and wild. Sometimes she fought with the older children, the ones who tried to grab the old stale bread she had found. She swore at them. She hit them. She felt dangerous, savage. At first, she had not looked at the smaller children. They reminded her too much of her brother. But now she felt she had to help them. They were vulnerable, small, so pathetic, so dirty. A lot of them had diarrhea. Their clothes were caked with shit. There was no one to wash them, no one to feed them. Little by little, she came to know their names, their ages, but some of them were so small they could hardly answer her. They were thankful for a warm voice, for a smile, a kiss, and they followed her around the camp, dozens of them, trailing after her like bedraggled sparrows. She would tell them the story she used to tell her brother before his bedtime. At night, lying on the lice-infested straw, where rats made rustling noises, she would whisper the stories, making them even longer than they usually were. The older children were gathered around, too. Some of them pretended not to listen, but she knew they did. There was an 11-year-old girl, a tall, black-haired creature called Rachel, who often looked at her with a touch of contempt. But night after night, she listened to the stories, creeping closer to the girl so that she wouldn't miss one word. And once, when most of the little children were at last asleep, she spoke to the girl. She said in a deep, hoarse voice,
"We should leave. We should escape."
The girl shook her head.
"There's no way out. The police have guns. We can't escape."
Rachel shrugged her bony shoulders.
"I'm going to escape."
"What about your mother? She will be waiting for you in the other camp, like mine."
Rachel smiled.
"You believed all that? You believed what they said?"
The girl hated Rachel's knowing smile.
"No," she said firmly. "I didn't believe them. I don't believe anything anymore."
"Neither do I," said Rachel. "I saw what they did. They didn't even write down the little children's names properly. They tied on those small tags that got mixed up when most of the children took them off again. They don't care. They lied to all of us. To us and to our mothers."
And to the girl's surprise, Rachel reached out and took her hand. She held it tight the way Armel used to. Then she got to her feet and disappeared. The next morning they were woken very early. The policemen came into the barracks, pushing at them with their truncheons. The smaller children, hardly awake, started to scream. The girl tried to calm the ones nearest to her, but they were terrified. They were led into a shed. The girl held two toddlers by the hand. She saw a policeman holding an instrument in his hand. It had a strange shape. She didn't know what it was. The toddlers gasped with fear, backed away. They were slapped and kicked by the policeman, then dragged toward the man with the instrument. The girl watched, horrified. Then she understood. Their hair was being shaved off. All the children were to be shaved. She looked on as Rachel's thick, black hair fell to the floor. Her naked skull was white and pointed like an egg. Rachel gazed at the men with hatred and contempt. She spat on their shoes. One of the gendarmes knocked her aside brutally. The little ones were frantic. They had to be held down by two or three men. When it was her turn, the girl did not struggle. She bent her head. She felt the cold pressure of the machine and closed her eyes, unable to bear the sight of the long, golden strands falling to her feet. Her hair. Her beautiful hair that everyone admired. She felt sobs welling up in her throat. but she forced herself not to cry. Never cry in front of these men. Never cry. Ever. It's only hair. Hair will grow back. It was nearly over. She opened her eyes again. The policeman holding her had fat pink hands. She looked up at him while the other man shaved off the last locks. It was the red-haired, friendly policeman from her neighborhood, the one her mother used to chat with, the one who always had a wink for her on her way to school, the one she had waved to the day of the roundup, the one who had looked away. He was too close now to look away. She held his gaze, not glancing down once. His eyes were a strange yellowish color, like gold. His face was red with embarrassment, and she thought she felt him tremble. She said nothing, staring at him with all the contempt she could muster. He could only look back at her, motionless. The girl smiled, a bitter smile for a child of 10, and brushed off his heavy hands. I left the nursing home in a sort of daze. I was due at the office, where Bamber was waiting for me, but I found myself heading back to the Rue de Saint-Ange. There were so many questions going around my head that I felt swamped. Was Mamet telling the truth, or had she gotten mixed up, confused, due to her illness? Had there really been a Jewish family living here? How could the Tézac have moved in and not known anything, as Mamet had stated? I walked slowly through the courtyard. The concierge's loge would have been here, I thought. It had been transformed years ago into a small apartment. A row of metal mailboxes lined the hallway. There was no longer a concierge who brought mail up every day to each door. Madame Royer, that was her name, Mamet had said. I had read much about concierges and their particular role during the arrests. Most of them had complied with police orders, and some had even gone further, showing the police where certain Jewish families had gone into hiding. Others had plundered vacant apartments and hoarded goods right after the roundup. Only a few, I read, had protected the Jewish families the best they could. I wondered what sort of role Madame Royer had played here. I thought fleetingly of my concierge on the Boulevard de Montparnasse. She was my age, and from Portugal. She had not known the war. I ignored the elevator and walked up the four flights. The workmen were out on their lunch hour. The building was silent. As I opened the front door, I felt something strange engulf me, an unknown sensation of despair and emptiness. I walked to the older part of the apartment, the bit that Bertrand had shown us the other day. This is where it had happened. This is where the men came knocking on that hot July morning just before dawn. It seemed to me that everything I had read in the past weeks, everything I had learned about the Veldive came to a head here, in the very place I was about to live in. All the testimonies I had pored over, all the books I had studied, all the survivors and witnesses I had interviewed made me understand, made me see with an almost unreal clarity what had happened between the walls that I now touched. The article I had started to write a couple of days ago was nearly finished. My deadline was coming up. I still had to visit the Loiret camps outside Paris and Drancy, and I had a meeting scheduled with Franck Lévy, whose association was organizing most of the commemorations for the 60th anniversary of the roundup. Soon my investigation would be over, and I'd be writing about something else. But now that I knew what had happened here, so close to me, so intimately linked to me, to my life, I felt I had to find out more. My search wasn't over. I felt I had to know everything. What had happened to the Jewish family living in this place? What were their names? Were there any children? Had anybody come back from the death camps? Was everybody dead? I wandered through the empty apartment. In one room, the wall was being torn down. Lost in the rubble, I noticed a long, deep opening, cleverly hidden behind a panel. It was now partly revealed. It would have made a good hiding place. If these walls could talk. But I didn't need them to talk. I knew what had happened here. I could see it. The survivors had told me about the hot, still night, the bangs on the doors, the brisk orders, the bus ride through Paris. They had told me about the stinking hell of Veldiv. The ones who told me were the ones who lived, the ones who got away, the ones who tore off their stars and escaped. I wondered suddenly if I could cope with this knowledge, if I could live here knowing that in my apartment a family had been arrested and sent on to their probable deaths. How had the Tezac lived with that, I wondered. I pulled out my cell phone and called Bertrand. When he saw my number show up, he mumbled, "Meeting." That was our code for "I'm busy." "It's urgent," I said. I heard him murmur something, then his voice came across clearly.
"What's up, Amour?" he said. "Make it quick, I've got something waiting."
I took a deep breath. "Bertrand," I said, "do you know how your grandparents got the Rue de Saint-Ange apartment?"
"No," he said. "Why?"
"I've just been to see Mamay. She told me they moved in during July of 42. She said the place had been emptied because of a Jewish family arrested during the Veldiv roundup." Silence.
"So?"
asked Bertrand, finally. I felt my face go hot. My voice echoed out through the empty apartment. "But doesn't it bother you that your family moved in, knowing the Jewish people had been arrested? Did they ever tell you about it?" I could almost hear him shrug in that typical French fashion, the downturn of the mouth, the arched eyebrows.
"No, it doesn't bother me. I didn't know. They never told me. But it still doesn't bother me. I'm sure a lot of Parisians moved into empty apartments in July of 42 after the roundup. Surely that doesn't make my family collaborationists, does it?"
His laugh hurt my ears. "I never said that, Bertrand."
"You're getting too heated up about all this, Julia," he said with a gentler tone. "This happened 60 years ago, you know. There was a world war going on, remember? Tough times for everybody."
I sighed. "I just want to know how it happened. I just don't understand."
"It's simple, mon ange. My grandparents had a hard time during the war. The antique shop wasn't doing well. They were probably relieved to move into a bigger, better place. After all, they had a child. They were young. They were glad to find a roof over their heads. They probably didn't think twice about the Jewish family."
"Oh, Bertrand," I whispered. "How could they not think about that family? How could they not?" He blew kisses down the phone.
"They didn't know, I guess. I've got to go, Emma. See you tonight."
And he hung up. I stayed in the apartment for a while, walking down the long corridor, standing in the empty living room, running my palm along the smooth marble mantelpiece, trying to understand, trying not to let my emotions overwhelm me. With Rachel, she had made up her mind. They were going to escape. They were going to leave this place. It was that or die. She knew it. She knew that if she stayed here with the other children, it would be the end. Many of the children were ill. Half a dozen had already died. Once, she had seen a nurse, like the one in the stadium, a woman with a blue veil. One nurse for so many sick, starving children. Escaping was their secret. They had not told any of the other children. No one was to guess anything. They were going to escape in broad daylight. They had noticed that during the day, at most times, the policemen hardly paid attention to them. It could be easy and fast, down behind the sheds, toward the water tower, where the village women had tried to push food through the barbed wire. They had found a small gap in the rolls of wire. Small, but maybe big enough for a child to crawl through. Some children had already left the camp, surrounded by policemen. She had watched them leave, frail, thin creatures with their shorn heads and ragged clothes. Where were they being taken? Far away? To the mothers and fathers? She didn't believe that. Rachel didn't either. If they were all to be taken to the same place, why had the police separated the parents from the children in the first place? Why so much pain, so much suffering, thought the girl.
It's because they hate us,
Rachel had told her with her deep, hoarse voice.
They hate Jews.
Such hate, thought the girl. Why such hate? She had never hated anyone in her life, except perhaps a teacher. Once. A teacher who had severely punished her because she had not learned her lesson. Had she ever wished that woman dead? She pondered. Yes, she had. So maybe that's how it worked. That's how all this had happened. Hating people so much that you wanted to kill them. Hating them because they wore a yellow star. It made her shiver. She felt as if all the evil, all the hatred in the world was concentrated right here, stocked up all around her, in the policemen's hard faces, in their indifference, their disdain. And outside the camp, did everybody hate Jews too? Is this what her life was going to be about from now on? She remembered last June, overhearing neighbors in the stairway on her way home from school, feminine voices, lowered to whispers. She had paused on the stairs, her ears cocked like a puppy's.
And do you know, his jacket opened and there it was, the star. I never would have thought he was a Jew.
She heard the other woman's sharp intake of breath.
Him, a Jew. Such a proper gentleman, too. What a surprise.
She had asked her mother why some of the neighbors didn't like Jewish people. Her mother had shrugged, had sighed, bending her head over her ironing. But she had not answered the girl. So the girl had gone to see her father. What was wrong with being a Jew? Why did some people hate Jews? Her father had scratched his head, had looked down at her with a quizzical smile. He had said, hesitatingly,
"Because they think we are different, so they are frightened of us."
But what was different, thought the girl. What was so different? Her mother, her father, her brother. She missed them so much she felt physically ill. She felt as if she had fallen into a bottomless hole. Escaping was the only way for her to have some sort of grip on her life, this new life she could not understand. Maybe her parents had managed to escape as well. Maybe they were able to make their way back home. Maybe. Maybe. She thought of the empty apartment, the unmade beds, the food slowly rotting in the kitchen, and her brother in that silence, in the dead silence of the place. Rachel touched her arm, making her jump.
Now, she whispered. Let's try now.
The camp was silent, almost deserted. Since the adults had been taken away, there were fewer policemen, they had noticed. And the policemen hardly talked to the children. They left them alone. The heat pounded down on the sheds, unbearable. Inside, feeble, sick children lay on damp straw. The girls could hear male voices and laughs from farther on. The men were probably in one of the barracks, keeping out of the sun. The only policeman they could see was sitting in the shade, his rifle at his feet. His head was tilted back against the wall, and he seemed fast asleep, his mouth open. They crept toward the fences like quick, small animals. They could glimpse green meadows and fields stretching before them. Silence. Still. Heat and silence. Had anybody seen them? They crouched in the grass, hearts pounding. They peered back over their shoulders. No movement. No noise. Was it that easy? Thought the girl. No. It couldn't be. Nothing was ever easy. Not anymore. Rachel was clutching a bundle of clothes in her arms. She urged the girl to put them on. The extra layers would protect their skin against the barbs, she said. The girl shuddered as she struggled into a dirty, ragged sweater, a tight, tattered pair of trousers. Who had these clothes belonged to, she wondered. Some poor, dead child whose mother had gone and who had been left here to die alone? Still crouching, they drew near the small gap in the rolls of wire. There was a policeman standing a little way off. They could not make out his face, just the sharp outline of his high, round cap. Rachel pointed to the opening in the wire. They would have to hurry now. No time to waste. They got down on their stomachs, snaked their way to the hole. It seemed so small, thought the girl. How could they possibly wriggle through, not cut themselves on the barbed wire despite the extra clothes? How did they ever think they were going to make it? That nobody was going to see them? That they'd get away with it? They were crazy, she thought. Crazy. The grass tickled her nose. It smelled delicious. She wanted to bury her face in it and breathe in the green, tangy scent. She saw that Rachel had already reached the gap and was gingerly pushing her head through it. Suddenly, the girl heard heavy thuds on the grass. Her heart stopped. She looked up to a huge shape looming over her. A policeman. He dragged her up by the frayed collar of her blouse, shook her. She felt herself go limp with terror.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
His voice hissing in her ear. Rachel was halfway through the rolls. The man, still holding the girl by the scruff of her neck, reached down and seized Rachel's ankle. She fought and kicked, but he was too strong, pulling her back through the barbed wire, her face and hands bleeding. They stood in front of him, Rachel sobbing, the girl straight-backed, her chin up. Inside she was trembling, but she had decided she would not show her fear. At least she was going to try. And then she looked up at him and gasped. It was the red-haired policeman. He recognized her instantly. She saw his Adam's apple bob, felt the thick hand on her collar quiver.
You can't escape, he said gruffly. You must stay here, you understand?
He was young, just over 20, massive and pink-skinned. The girl noticed he was sweating under the thick, dark uniform. His forehead was glistening with moisture, his upper lip, too. His eyes blinked. He shifted from foot to foot. She realized she was not afraid of him. She felt a sort of strange pity for him, which puzzled her. She put her hand on his arm. He looked down at it with surprise and embarrassment. She said,
"You remember me, don't you?"
It was not a question. It was a fact. He nodded, dabbing at the moist patch under his nose. She took the key from her pocket and showed it to him. Her hand did not waver.
You remember my little brother, she said. The little blonde boy with the curly hair?
He nodded again.
You must let me go, monsieur. My little brother, monsieur, he is in Paris alone. I locked him in the cupboard because I thought...
Her voice broke.
I thought he'd be safe there. I must go back. Let me go through this hole. You can pretend you never saw me, monsieur.
The man glanced back over his shoulder, toward the sheds, as if he was afraid someone might come, someone might see them or hear them. He put a finger to his lips. He looked back at the girl. He screwed up his face, shook his head.
I can't do that, he said, his voice low. I have orders.
She pressed her hand down on his chest.
Please, monsieur, she said quietly.
Next to her, Rachel sniffed, her face clotted with blood and tears. The man glanced over his shoulder once more. He seemed deeply perturbed. She again noticed that strange expression on his face, the one she had glimpsed the day of the roundup, a mixture of pity, shame, and anger. The girl felt the minutes go by, leaden, heavy, endless. She felt the sobs, the tears growing within her again, the panic. What was she going to do if he sent her and Rachel back to the barracks? How was she going to go on? How? She would try to escape again, she thought fiercely. Yes, she would do it over and over again. Over and over again. Suddenly, he said her name. He took her hand. His palm felt hot and clammy.
Go!
He said between clenched teeth, the sweat trickling down the sides of his pasty face.
Go! Now! Fast!
Bewildered, she looked up to the golden eyes. He pushed her toward the hole, forcing her down with his hand. He held up the wire, shoved her through violently. The barbed wire stung her forehead. Then it was over. She scrambled to her feet. She was free, standing on the other side. Rachel stared, motionless.
I want to go too,
Rachel said. The policeman clamped a hand on the back of her neck.
No, you are staying, he said.
Rachel wailed.
That's not fair! Why her and not me? Why?
He silenced her, raising his other hand. Behind the fence, the girl stood frozen to the spot. Why couldn't Rachel come with her? Why did Rachel have to stay?
Please let her come, said the girl. Please, monsieur.
She spoke with a calm, quiet voice. The voice of a young woman. The man seemed ill at ease, restless, but he didn't hesitate long.
Go then,
he said, pushing Rachel away.
Quickly!
He held the wire as Rachel crawled through. She stood next to the girl, breathless. The man fumbled in his pockets, pulled something out, and handed it to the girl, through the fence.
Take this,
he ordered. The girl looked at the thick wad of money in her hand. She put it in her pocket, next to the key. The man looked back toward the barracks, his brow furrowed.
For God's sake, run! Run now, quick, both of you. If they see you, take off your stars. Try to find help. Be careful. Good luck!
She wanted to thank him for his help, for the money. She wanted to hold her hand out to him, but Rachel grabbed her by the arm and took off. They ran as fast as they could through the high, golden wheat, straight ahead, lungs bursting, legs and arms helter-skelter, far away from the camp, as far away as possible. As I got home, I realized I'd been feeling nauseous for the past couple of days. I hadn't bothered about it, caught up in researching the Valdiv article. Then last week there had been the revelation concerning Mamet's apartment. But it was the soreness, the tenderness of my breasts that made me pay attention to my queasiness for the first time. I checked my cycle. Yes, I was late. But that had happened too in the past years. I finally went down to the pharmacie on the boulevard to buy a pregnancy test. Just to be sure. And there it was. A little blue line. I was pregnant. Pregnant. I couldn't believe it. I sat down in the kitchen and hardly dared breathe. The last pregnancy, 5 years ago, after 2 miscarriages, had been a nightmare. Early pain and bleeding, then the discovery that the egg was developing outside the womb in one of my tubes. There had been a difficult operation, and a messy aftermath, both mentally and physically. It had taken me a long time to get over it. One of my ovaries had been removed. The surgeon had said he was dubious about another pregnancy. And by then, I was already 40. The disappointment, the sadness in Bertrand's face. He never spoke about it, but I felt it. I knew it. The fact that he did not want to talk about his feelings, ever, made it worse. He kept it bottled up, away from me. The words that were never spoken grew like a tangible being between us. I had only talked about it to my psychiatrist, and with my very close friends. I remembered a recent weekend in Burgundy, when we had invited Isabelle and her husband and children to stay. Their daughter Mathilde was Zoe's age, and then there was little Mathieu. And the way Bertrand had looked at that little boy, a delightful little fellow of 4 or 5, Bertrand's eyes following him, Bertrand playing with him, carrying him around on his shoulders, smiling, but something sad and wistful in his eyes. It had been unbearable to me. Isabelle had found me crying alone in the kitchen while everybody was finishing their quiche Lorraine outside. She had hugged me hard, then poured out a hefty glass of wine and turned on the CD player and deafened me with old Diana Ross hits.
It's not your fault, Makakot. It's not your fault. Remember that.
I had felt incompetent for a long time. The Tezak family had been kind and discreet about the whole thing, but I still felt like I had not been able to provide Bertrand with what he wanted most badly, a second child. And most importantly, a son. Bertrand had two sisters and no brothers. The name would die out if there was no heir to carry it on. I had not realized how important that factor was for this particular family. When I had made it clear that despite being Bertrand's wife, I was still to be called Julia Jarmont, I was greeted with surprised silence. My mother-in-law, Colette, had explained to me with a wooden smile that in France that sort of attitude was modern, too modern, a feminist stance that did not go down well here at all. A French woman was to be known by her husband's name. I was to be, for the rest of my life, Madame Bertrand Tezac. I remember smiling my toothy white smile back at her and telling her glibly I was going to stick to Jarmont. She had said nothing.